Knowing Jesus is the best gift that any person can receive. That we've encountered Him as the best thing that's happened in our lives, and making Him known by our word and deeds is our greatest joy. If you're hungry for that encounter, if you're dying to know the love of God, which alone makes sense out of life, if you're longing to know that you matter so much and that His power can fill you with all that you need so that you can be the man or the woman that you want to be, then join me and dig into the Scriptures and the teachings of the Church so that we can find the life that Jesus has made us for.
Ave Maria Radio presents Christ is the Answer with Father John Ricardo. He's a priest of the Archdiocese of Detroit and is currently the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Acts 29, which exists to work with pastors and their teams to transform their parish culture and reclaim the church's missionary identity. He was ordained in 1996. Father Ricardo was one of the founders of the Put Out Into the Deep men's conferences in the Archdiocese of Detroit. It's something he's passionate about. He wants men to be men, to be the heads of their families. But more importantly, he wants men to have a personal relationship with Jesus, to be a friend of Jesus. That's an important part of Father Ricardo's first talk today. In March of 2013, the Archdiocese of Detroit had what they called a men's retreat. Archbishop Alan Vigneron opened with Mass. Father Ricardo was the first speaker. The title of his talk and the title of the conference, Tirelessly Running the Race. Here is Father John Ricardo.
I feel something like the ever-ready bunny who just keeps beating the drum, because I feel like I have one drum that I'm playing right now. And for the guys who belong to Our Lady of Good Counsel, the music's going to sound really familiar. But I'm just convinced it's the single message that God has me to deliver right now. There's a story of a young priest, kind of like a little Father Steve Matea, who's our associate here. Great guy, straight out of the chute, boom, just hitting home runs left and right. So there was a story of a similar kind of priest who gets assigned to St. Philip Neri, who was at this church called La Chiesa Nuova, the New Church in Rome. It's still called the New Church. It was built in the 1500s. So he came and he started preaching. He's doing this great job. He gave this awesome sermon one night. And Father Philip Neri heard him give it. He was really impressed, and he heard all the chatter from the people afterwards saying, wow, this guy's really got something. So Philip Neri, trying to both look out for his community and for the young priest, says to the priest maybe Thursday that week, hey, it was a good word last week. Why don't you give it again? So he gives the same sermon again the next week. And people, a lot of them didn't hear it the week before, so they're like, wow, this guy's really good. And then he continues to hear the chatter of all the people as they're saying things about this guy. And so he says, hey, you know what? There's still a lot of people who haven't heard you. Why don't you give it again this week? He ends up giving it 4 or 5 weeks in a row. And the talk in the community now becomes, guy's got like one sermon. That's all he gives. So I feel like that's me right now. I feel like I have one sermon. A priest friend of mine who's now passed away used to say that repeatedly. Every priest has one homily. And I agree with that more or less. We say the same thing over and over again. We just say it in different ways. But right now, I really have one thing I'm convinced that Jesus is asking me to say. These are obviously really exciting days in the church. And we're going to have a new pope next week. Probably by Friday, maybe even earlier than that. The conclave starts on Tuesday. I'm sure many of us have our little favorites. I got mine. He's a guy in New York. It'd be awesome if we had a pope like him, from my perspective, who is just brimming with enthusiasm, who is joyful as all get out, and who's got this incredible capacity to draw people in, who can speak truth, and not just with charity, but with joy. The successor of the apostles who's presiding in New York right now would be my choice, but I don't have a vote, so it really doesn't matter. But it's been interesting if you followed all the little talk about what's going on in Rome right now and the chatter. The cardinals, when they were talking about what's been happening in their deliberations, these meetings before the conclave, to the degree that they can talk about what they're talking about, they're all mentioning one thing. There's a set of things that are coming up, but there's one thing in particular that they're talking about that they want the next pope to be well-versed in, and more than just well-versed in, able to do. And the one thing is the new evangelization. Now, that's an expression which is probably familiar to a number of us and maybe not so much to a number of others of us. What's the new evangelization? Well, it's not a new gospel. you following all these little surveys that are going on of American Catholics right now? They're doing polls. What should the church do? As if somehow that's what's going to happen. Can you imagine opinion polls when Jesus was walking around Galilee? 8 out of 10 people surveyed found this whole talk about, you know, whoever lusts after a woman in his heart, well, that's just a bit repressive and not very realistic. 10 out of 10 people surveyed said, picking up my cross every day is just over the top. 9 out of 10 of the listeners at the Sermon on the Mount or at the Bread of Life discourse found Jesus' words about his real presence being given to us to eat too literal. They preferred a more symbolic understanding of that. The gospel isn't new. It's the same gospel. The church in this country one day might wake up to it. We're never going to change our teachings on the dignity of human life or sexual morality. So what's new in the new evangelization? Well, Pope John Paul II is the one who really began to push this expression. And he said the new evangelization is new in 3 things. It's new in ardor, new in method, and new in expression. Might be worth asking, why do we need a new evangelization? What's wrong with the old evangelization? Well, what's wrong with the old evangelization is it doesn't work, quite simply. At least it doesn't work anymore. We are, not just as a church in the United States, but as the body of Christ in the world, in a time of crisis. Crisis not meaning so much a time of disaster, a crisis more in the sense of a time which is pregnant with an opportunity for change. And if you read the media, especially in our country, you're going to hear all sorts of different speculations or opinions upon what is the crisis in the church. And it's usually the same old list of things, right? It's the sexual abuse scandals of priests, and not just priests, but others. It's lack of financial transparency or improper handling of money, whatnot. Those are real problems, don't get me wrong. I can tell you, as a priest in particular, what the abuse scandal has meant to us. I mean, you should see the looks we get sometimes from people. There's no question this has, especially perhaps in our country, left a really traumatic and deep wound, which I don't know that we're going to get out of, at least in my lifetime. But, you know, to be a student of history, especially to be a student of church history, is to know this is actually rather normal. So all the Vatican leaks come out, you know. Oh my gosh, did you hear what's happening in the Vatican? Do you think it's true that there might be scandal in the Curia? Hello? How could there not be? I mean, really, how could there not be? Just like the Archbishop said in his sermon, huh? We like sin. I like sin. It's attractive. It's alluring. It's glamorous. We're proud. We're vain. We're egotistical, we're power hungry, we're all these things. And without God's hand upon us, or without us regularly walking underneath the shadow of his hand and staying close to him, we're capable of everything. There was a great line in the Lenten Companion for the Magnificat from St. Thomas Aquinas, where he simply says, "It is a sin to be scandalized by your sinfulness." Isn't that a comforting truth? You know, we hear people say all the time, perhaps some of us say, you know, somebody falls and, you know, some tragedy happens. And our response often is, oh, I would never do that. Really? I'd do anything. I mean, the saints talked like that. The saints never said, oh, I would never do that. I don't understand how that was possible. The saints always said, if God's hand wasn't on me, I'd be out there doing everything and more that the world is doing. It's a sin to be scandalized by our own sinfulness. And the church is, unfortunately, full of sin, because the church is us. Not just the guys in the red robes over in Rome right now. The church is us. The body of Christ is a mess. But that's all right. God can handle this. But those aren't the crisis. The crisis isn't the Vatileak scandal. The crisis isn't, as serious as it is, the sexual abuse scandal. It's not mismanagement of funds. The crisis is unfortunately, it's a lot more personal than that. It has to do with me and it has to do with you, not with them. The crisis, I think, is this. We don't know Jesus. I think that's the crisis. Perfect first reading for today. Let us strive to know the Lord. Quick question to you and me right now. Is that what you and I are doing every single day? When you and I wake up every day, do we strive to know Jesus or not? In the Old Testament, in the same book of Hosea, a little bit later on, it's in chapter 14, the Lord says through the prophet, "My people perish," or in another translation, "My people are being destroyed because of a lack of knowledge." Not a lack of data. We got tons of data. Not a lack of information. We got a lot of information. Not just about things that are happening in the world. We got a lot of data, a lot of knowledge, a lot of information about God, but not a lot of intimacy with God. Not a lot of relationship with God. Not a lot of friendship. That's the cry of God's heart. God wants to give himself to us in the incredible gift of friendship, and we're not taking advantage of it in the church. There's a survey done in the past few years among Catholics that said a majority of baptized Catholics don't even think that's possible. Just came across this in the last couple of months. I was stunned by the statistic. You might have heard me say it, or you might have read it yourself, or heard somebody else say it. 48% of Catholics, get this, 48% of Catholics said they were absolutely certain that the God they believed in was a God with whom you can have a personal relationship. 48%. Less than half. More than half of Catholics don't even think you can have a friendship with Jesus. And only 60% of Catholics who were surveyed even thought that God was a personal being. That's the crisis. That's the problem. That's why we need a new evangelization, because the old one, it wasn't working. What was the old one? The old one was something like this. We just kind of presumed in the church that if we sent our children to a Catholic school and they learned the faith and religion classes and they wore a uniform and they saw a crucifix on the wall and they came to church, whether it was every day like I did or once a week like some places do now, if they went to after school religious education and, you know, we took them to church, you know, regularly, you know, once a month, something like that, they'd get it. How'd that work out? Not so great. Same survey that I stumbled across in a book, it says that, I just find this staggering, huh? Only 30% of Catholics, or those who were raised Catholics as adults, are now practicing Catholics. Only 30% of American Catholics as adults are still practicing. That was the old evangelization. The old evangelization doesn't work. I run into people over and over again who tell me that they've grown up Catholic, but they, in all honesty, have zero relationship with Jesus. They got baptized, they got confirmed, they go to Mass once in a while, they go to confession maybe once a year, maybe not. They have, as Pope John Paul II used to say, the capacity to be disciples, but they're not disciples. They've reduced the faith in one way or another to one of two things, typically. Either trying to be good, or being active, serving some way. Don't get me wrong, those are two pretty important things. We're going to be judged by what we do, so being good is important. And we're a call to serve each other. And as men, I think we do that pretty easily. We find fulfillment in getting our hands dirty and working, being of benefit to others. But that's not the Christian life. Those are a part of the Christian life, but that's not the Christian life. That's not the essence of the Christian life. I repeat, I'm sure ad nauseum to the guys who are here, a line from Pope Benedict Emeritus now, who used to say over and over again, to be a Christian is not the result of an ethical choice, but the result of an event, an encounter, a meeting with the living God in the person of Jesus Christ. This and nothing less is what it means to be a Christian, he said. He said in another place, faith is above all a personal, intimate encounter with Jesus, experiencing his closeness, his friendship, and his love. Only in this way does one learn to know him evermore and to love and follow him ever more closely. When's the last time you met him? We just did, actually, from the altar, but I mean, how many of us were really conscious of what was happening? Matt Greenow and I talk often about the need to just drive home what the church taught in the Second Vatican Council of full, active, conscious participation in the Mass. Unfortunately, many of us come to Mass, not us, of course, but other people, when they come to Mass, they come to Mass, in the expression the council uses, as silent spectators. You know, like we're up here doing our thing, Father Sean and I, the Archbishop, and we're talking, and, you know, we're doing all the gestures, and we're sitting out there going, a couple of lights out. How do they dust the crucifix? Is that one piece of wood? I bet they never dust those flowers up there. I don't think we do either. I've been here 6 years and I don't think, do we dust those flowers? I didn't think so. Yeah. Full conscious active participation. We just met Jesus. How many of us really knew what to do when we met him? I don't think a lot of us do know what to do. We know we should be doing something, but what? So we said the new evangelization is new in ardor. That's a kind of old-fashioned word. What in the world is ardor? Ardor is zeal, fervor, passion. Are you passionate about Jesus? Passionate about Jesus. Are you zealous for Jesus? Are you fervent for Jesus? Are we fervent for the gospel? Are we passionate about helping this world come to know him? Is that true? It's not true for most people in the church. Maybe we could put it more simply like this as men. Is Jesus my best friend? Is he your best friend? I'm looking around the church. There's a set of guys in here who have great man caves. As I was praying this morning, I felt like the Lord said, hey, when are you going to come to my man cave? Like, you guys think a flat screen TV is really cool. Well, you should see what I got to offer. When are you going to hang out with me? Because I and I alone, he says, can really give you what it is you're longing for. Whoever it is we're rooting for right now, they're going to lose eventually. Or whatever it is that's occupying our time, one day we're going to realize it really wasn't that important. Why aren't we hanging out with the one who alone can show us what life is really all about? When's the last time you hung out in the Lord's man cave? Do we do it every day? For most Catholics, Jesus is anything but their best friend. After all, most Catholics don't even think you can have a friendship with Jesus, so it's pretty hard for him to be their best friend. We just did our parish mission a couple weeks ago now, and I suggested that in the course of the mission that we do something like a little mini spiritual assessment of our lives. I don't have to show this to anybody, but a great chance for us just to, with real honesty, just between us and Jesus, ask ourselves some questions. First question, given the fact that half of Catholics don't think God is even personal, would be to ask ourselves that. Do I think God is personal? And then to ask myself, do I think a relationship with Jesus is possible? Do I have a relationship with Jesus? And if so, what's it look like? And then perhaps a little bit more awkwardly or painfully to ask Jesus from his perspective, what's the friendship that we have with him look like? How would he describe our friendship with him? That might be a hard conversation to have. I think we would, if we're honest, all of us would hear the Lord say something like, the way he always does. He always starts with the good things. You know, the seven letters to the churches and the book of Revelation is a great way to write letters to other people, by the way, or to have conversations with other people. You start with what's going well. You do this, this, and this really well. I love it. Thank you. Here's what you're lacking. And I think for many of us as men, what the Lord's communicating at that second part of the letter or the second part of the conversation is, here's what we're lacking. You don't ever spend enough time with me. You have no idea what I'm trying to offer you in the gift of my friendship. Or if you do, you don't make time for it. And if you would but come to me, I would change your life like that. But you don't come. Not with the regularity that I want you to come. Not with the ardor and the fervor and the passion that I want you to come. I have a hunch, more than a hunch, that's what he says to me. And I got a hunch that's what he would say to many of us. What kind of friendship does he have with Paco, Father Sean, the Archbishop, with me? That is the gist of the Christian life. The second thing we said that's new, or the Pope said that's new about the new evangelization, is it's new in method, new in ardor, new in method, new in expression, new in method. That is, it's new in finding ways to bring people into an encounter with Jesus. And as I mentioned at the beginning, this is the one thing that I'm convinced the Lord just wants me to talk about. We're seeing amazing things happening at this parish right now. And I'm talking a lot of late about two experiences that have taken place, one with men and women who are in RCIA. There's 53 people, I think, coming into the church this year here. And we took them on retreat about 6 weeks ago. And then perhaps the single greatest thing that I think is happening in this parish is what's happening in our teens. I've never seen anything like this. And we take them on retreat. And we took them on retreat last weekend. And somehow I'm trying to prayerfully find out or figure out a way where we can replicate for not just this parish, but for every parish. This is what I want to talk to the Archbishop about with regards to the new evangelization, because I'm convinced that what we're seeing is what has to happen if the crisis is going to get solved. What has to happen is we have to have deep experiential encounters of Jesus. And that's what happened this past weekend. The only common denominator between the RCIA retreat and the Life Team retreat, we do Life Team ministry here, is that Jesus was present in the Blessed Sacrament, exposed on the altar in one place and a living room in another place, which we had turned into an altar for the entire time. It's the only thing we had in common. So this past weekend, 25 teens, together with about 10, 11 adult core members of the parish, headed off to a parishioner's house over in Jackson. Kind of a motley crew of teenagers, you know, a collection of athletes, musicians, good students, all the personalities and temperaments that teenagers have. They didn't all fit in one box. They occupied all the boxes in the teenage spectrum, you know. At the start of the retreat, we gave them all a fishing net. And the challenge was to, by the end of the retreat, leave your net, to drop your net. I'm thinking how fitting that theme is for the men's conference. When Paco and I and Mike Timmis began the men's conferences, the title was always Put Out into the Deep, which comes from Luke 5 and the call of St. Peter. And the end of that call of St. Peter, not in Luke's version, but in Matthew's version, says that after they heard Jesus call them by name, they dropped their nets and followed. So the challenge to the teens was to drop their nets, to hear the Lord call their name through his voice, and to drop the nets, to follow, to be disciples. What does that not mean? It doesn't mean that you don't struggle anymore. It doesn't mean that you don't fall. It doesn't mean that you don't sin. Peter had countless blunders after he dropped his nets. It doesn't mean that you're canonized. It doesn't mean that you've all of a sudden got it all together. That's not what dropping the nets means. It means I've heard Jesus call me by name, and I have made the decision to follow him. I've made the decision to no longer live for me, but for him who for my sake did that. That's what it means to drop the nets. It means that though I still live very much in the midst of the world, and though the world might be alluring and charming and glamorous, and though sin might be attractive, I've recognized that the world cannot offer me enough. I want more. And the more is not something, the more is someone. And the someone is Jesus. And I'm convinced that he and he alone has the answer to my life, and I want to follow him. That's what it means to drop the nets. The first night, Friday night, you know, we sang. Adam came with us and led us in worship. We ate. We had a lot of fun together, and we slept a little bit, you know, maybe not so much on the sleeping part, but we're all there together the whole time. And the first night, one of the women described that she saw one of the guys, he's kind of on his knees here in front of the table, and which we kind of converted into an altar, and he's got a journal. We gave every kid a journal. So he's got a journal in one hand, and he's got his net in the other hand. And he's looking at the net. He's looking at his journal, and he just kept going like this. He kept getting closer to the altar, to Jesus and the Eucharist. And she said it was this extraordinary thing to just kind of watch him look at the Lord, clearly talking to the Lord. We'd ask them all to consider, what is my net? What's keeping me from following him? And then at a certain point, he just kind of got right up in front of the Blessed Sacrament and dropped his net. And she was so inspired. By Sunday afternoon, there were 25 nets in front of the altar. These are really normal kids. So as we're talking about leaving the retreat and heading back here for Mass, we're trying to figure out, how is it that the Lord wants us to communicate to this parish as a whole what it is that God has done in our midst? Because we knew we had to say something. Oftentimes, you know, in the Old Testament, the Lord called the prophets to do a prophetic act. And the prophetic act would be a sign that the prophet would give to the people. And so on Sunday, after I got done preaching, I just sat down right where Father Sean is, and we just had the teens start to come up out of the congregation. So one came up first, and he just kind of walked right up into the sanctuary, and he dropped his net here, and then he sat down right here. And then two by two, all the teens came up with their nets, and they just piled them on top of each other. And then lastly, one teen who just had this incredible experience in the retreat, he came up, stood, and just let his net fall on top of the other one so you could hear it. Sat down. They all held hands, had their heads down because they didn't want the attention on them, and they looked out. And then at the end of the Mass, one of the young women, she's a junior in high school, this extraordinary young woman, really, came up from her perspective, just told what the Lord had done. And she ended with a challenge. And the challenge was to the whole parish to do what they've done, to drop their nets. And when she got done, starting right over there, this place went into an instantaneous standing ovation. But it was intended to provoke jealousy, like a holy jealousy. Like, we wanted the kids up here to say to all the people in the parish, we want you to want what happened to us. Because here's the irony. Here's a set of people who are teenagers, or in the case of the folks in RCAA, some of whom are not yet even baptized. They have already had intense, I'm not talking about emotional highs, intense experiential encounters with the living and risen Jesus that some of us who've grown up Catholic our whole lives long and for decades have come to church have never had. Perhaps because we've never made the time. Or perhaps because we in the church have just done a pathetic job relying on the old model, the old evangelization of hoping that that would happen. That doesn't happen. But when we give Jesus a chance to work, it happens. I tell oftentimes an experience that I had at Divine Child when I was a young priest, 1 year ordained. First time I ever really saw the power of the Blessed Sacrament. And we simply exposed the Blessed Sacrament at the end of Mass one night. I encouraged people. I said, you know what? We'd been in the habit of praying over people after Mass. I said, we're not going to do that this week. I'm just going to invite people to come on up and pray if they want to pray. And I put the Blessed Sacrament on the altar. I put a couple of kneelers in the sanctuary, hoping that maybe a couple people would have the courage to come up. I'm going around, you know, back at the tabernacle, getting the monstrance, that's the vessel that holds the Blessed Sacrament, ready. Put it on the altar. I can hear some commotion over here. I kneel down. As I kneel down, the church is in the sanctuary. The whole church. It's just like the scene in the gospel. They just rushed the stage. And as I'm looking at this, kind of dumbfounded, because this was not part of my experience as a young man growing up at all. I never saw a Eucharistic exposition, ever, that I can remember. Ever. Never went to it, never saw it. And as I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at the people there, and I'm looking at Jesus under the appearance of bread there, I see the Lord, I don't know if this was a vision or what, but I saw the Lord standing on the altar. And he's just standing there looking out at all the people. And then at a certain point, he turned towards me, and he just bowed. And he says, don't you see how easy this is? You don't have to do anything. You just have to put me out. You put me out and I will work. That was almost 16 years ago. And it was from that moment on that I have been convinced of the power of praying in front of the Blessed Sacrament. Jesus says, I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. Very first men's conference we did more than 10 years ago, I challenged those of you who were present to do something. The challenge was to pray an hour a day. I'll be really honest, guys. I don't think most of us do it. And I feel like the Lord wants to be really honest through me to all of us today. I don't think we can be saints and not do it. I don't know that we can call ourselves friends of Jesus if we don't spend time with Jesus. We can do a lot of great things. We can serve, we can be good, we can care for our families, but we won't be doing what he made us to do. The theme of the day, huh, is tirelessly running the race. I kept laughing because every time that I prepare a talk, God just kind of chucks the talk. So here's what I felt like the Lord wanted to say. He didn't want to so much speak through me, maybe he's going to do this through Paco, about tirelessly running the race. I think Jesus wanted to ask us through me, have we even entered it? Forget about tirelessly running the race. Have you got the little badge with the number on it that you pin onto your shirt that says you're running? I think a lot of us are on the sidelines. We're here, praise God, don't get me wrong. And some of us are doing it, although we can always run better. But there's a lot of us, we've made the commitment to sign up for the race. And wouldn't it be something if we left today, all of us had dropped our nets and we were all running? What's it mean to run? Here's the new challenge. At least 1 hour a week in front of the Blessed Sacrament. At least 1 hour a week in front of the Blessed Sacrament with the goal of an hour a day in front of the Blessed Sacrament. I had a guy come up to me at the end of the mission that we did here in the parish. He says, Father, you know, I'm doing a lot of things. I'm in a men's fellowship. I pray with my wife every day. I go to Mass every Sunday and usually a couple times during the week. I read scripture. He goes, I want more. I said, do you pray in front of the Blessed Sacrament? He said, outside of Mass, no. I said, I think that's the more. See, all these saints, These are the ones who surround us. These are the ones who ran before us. These are the ones who fought well, who kept the faith. They would tell you, as would every single saint in heaven right now, you cannot run this race if you don't spend time with the Master. Whatever else we're doing, it's second, third, and fourth. First things need to be first. And the first thing is to be with the Master. And the Master is Jesus. I read something this morning. I'll share with this and then I'll leave. This is the Lord speaking to us. I thought it was maybe a fitting word for us to conclude with. Many people are so cold toward me. Like children, they're impressed only by what they can touch and see. I have given them their greatest treasure in the Blessed Sacrament. Through my apostles and their successors, I have promised to be personally present wherever the Blessed Sacrament is. Make every effort to be deeply impressed by this greatest of all earthly gifts. It is not enough for you to believe in my real presence upon the altar. I placed myself there for love of you. I wanted to be near you in some visible way so that you might visit me as often as you wished. You should wish it as often as possible. People come to me for different reasons. Some come only on Sundays and holy days through a sense of obligation. Either they do not want to lose heaven or they desire my help in their daily life. Then there are those who come to me through mere habit. They act automatically without any particular devotion to me. There are, however, a certain number who come to me for the best reason. They come to me because they are glad to be near me. These people please me best of all. They receive many extra graces which are not granted to others. Consider how devoted my saints were to me. They seized every opportunity to visit me and stay with me. They desired to abandon all useless interests so that they might have more time with me. And in return for this generosity with me, they received a clearer understanding of my boundless goodness and a deeper appreciation of my infinite love. You too have the opportunity to give me more of your time and attention. Make a greater effort to come closer to me in friendship. You have the privilege of kneeling before me like the simple, wonderful shepherds, the tired, admiring magi, the suffering, begging leper, the penitent, hopeful Magdalene, the convicted, converted Thomas. How are you taking advantage of this privilege? I think that's the challenge, guys. The Master of all creation, King of heaven and earth, is inviting you and me to a friendship, to drop the nets, to consider following him, to put him truly first, to get into the habit daily of wasting time with him. Until we do it, nothing will work. Let's pray for the grace to do it.
That was Father John Ricardo with the keynote talk from the 2013 Archdiocese of Detroit Men's Event. At another men's conference in Massachusetts, he presented this talk that he recreated for our microphones. Here's Father John Ricardo and a fireside chat with the Lord.
Okay, so picture the scene. We're the 11 apostles, and it's Easter Sunday. Only you and I don't know it's Easter yet. So far as we know, the most remarkable man we've ever met, a man whom we personally saw with our own eyes, open the eyes of several blind men, or make straight the limbs of a man who was paralyzed, drive out who knows how many demons out of possessed men and women, even saw him with our own eyes raise the dead three times. This man, for whom you and I have abandoned everything, and with whom we spent the last 3 years, is dead. And he didn't just die. He got tortured to death. One minute everything was fine, even if it seemed a bit ominous, and then the next minute, Judas, one of our best friends, been with us for the past 3 years, shows up in the Garden of Gethsemane, surrounded by police from the temple, and then all heck breaks loose. Swords are drawn, people are yelling, fists are getting thrown, and before you know it, Jesus, who no one could touch for these past 3 years, is suddenly just chained up like any common criminal and taken off. And what'd we do? We all ran away. Just hours before, some of us were sitting there in the comfort of the upper room telling Jesus that no matter how bad things ever got, we'd never betray him. How empty and indicting those words seem now. Now, to be clear, some of our friends, Peter and John, they didn't run away. They followed. from a distance, but at least they followed, and they saw some of the trial that took place, sham that it was. But the rest of us just hid, frightened that the guards were looking for us, and not just looking for us, but were going to arrest us and do to us what they were doing to Jesus, and oh, what they did to him. A show of a trial, and then a handing over to the cruelty of our enemies, the Romans who occupy our land, and they beat the living daylights out of him. They scourged him with whips that had little bits of bone and metal at the ends until his body was just one giant open wound, barely recognizable as a man anymore. Then they pushed into his head a crown of thorns. They spat upon him. They laughed at him. Finally, they nailed him to a tree. And you and I, his best friends, we weren't even there. And now here it is, several days later, and we're still up in that upper room, where once things were so great, where once life seemed so amazing and the future so limitless. But all we know now is fear and anxiety and confusion, and none of us has a clue what we're going to do with our lives anymore. And then suddenly, even though the doors are locked and the room is secure, there he is. Jesus is in the room. I mean, he didn't walk in through the door. He didn't climb in through the window. He just appeared in the middle of the room. And after a few moments of rubbing our eyes to make sure this isn't a vision or some sort of mass hallucination or something we can blame on bad mushrooms or too much wine or who knows what, it sinks in. He is alive. And just as this starts to sink in, we begin to think to ourselves, at least if I'm one of the apostles, I'm thinking to myself, uh-oh, this could get real ugly real quick. I mean, what in the world is he going to say to us? And more importantly, what in the world is he going to do to us? And then for the first time, he speaks. And I got to believe he breaks into this huge grin, sensing our apprehension, and says, peace. It's as if he said, relax, guys, I'm not here to lash out at you, even though you all bailed on me. I'm not here for vengeance. I'm here with good news, not bad news. And if I'm one of the apostles and you're one of the apostles, then I got to believe everyone at that point breathes this huge sigh of relief. But now imagine you're not just one of the apostles, but that you're Peter. Because everything has to be a bit different for Peter. To be sure, like the rest of the apostles, he's got to be amazed out of his mind that Jesus has risen from the dead, but he's also got to be on edge in a way that none of the other apostles are. This has to be the case. Why? Well, because he's the one who'd professed Jesus as the Christ. He was the one who had received from Jesus a new name and a bold commission to be the head of the church. It was to him that the keys of the kingdom were given some months before. On that Holy Thursday night, he was the one who had boasted that he would lay down his life for the Lord if things got rough. But when things got rough, what did Peter do? When he had the chance to speak up on Jesus' behalf, what'd he do? He bailed. He lied. He turned coward. He denied he even knew him, not just once, but three times, and to a slave girl at that. And he didn't just deny him. If you really understand what's happening in that third denial, it goes something like this. May God damn me to hell if I even know who he is. And so for these reasons alone, Peter has to feel a bit different than the rest of the apostles. Now, there is no record in John's Gospel of any conversation between Jesus and Peter on that Easter Sunday. 8 days later, the same Gospel tells us Jesus again shows up in the upper room, speaks with Thomas, doubting Thomas, who wasn't there on Easter, sticks his fingers in the wounds in his hands, puts his hand in the side. Thomas comes to be convinced that the Lord is alive, but no conversation with Peter that day. So how many more days and weeks go by? And then the Gospel tells us something really strange. As the weeks go by after the resurrection, Peter stands up one day and says to the others that he's going to go fishing. Fishing? Peter hasn't fished, so far as we know, for 3 years. Why in the world is Peter going fishing? Well, here's where I think Peter went fishing. I think he went fishing because he probably figured that all of those grandiose, lofty, and amazing things that Jesus had said to him about being the rock, about having the keys of the kingdom and all the rest of that stuff, all that was over. After what he'd done, after how bad he'd blown it, no way. Peter was probably figuring that the Lord would look for someone else, someone more deserving, someone more worthy. And so he goes back out to fish, back to his old life, wondering what would have happened had things had been different, if only he hadn't blown it. Why do I think that way? Well, because that's how I think. At least that's how I'm tempted to think. Isn't that how we all think? Don't we figure that things are great with us and God so long as we somehow keep the scales balanced? But the moment we blow it, well, that's it. God scratches off another one on the list of potential followers who could have done something great for him, and he moves on to someone else, someone who won't blow it. I have to believe that's where some of us are here today. I've been involved in the men's conference here in the Archdiocese of Detroit for 6 years now, and we get men from all over the spectrum. Some of us have been at every conference. Some of us have been sporadically. Some came reluctantly at the invitation of a friend, perhaps. Some of us came here thinking, man, the moment they join hands and sing Kumbaya, I am gone. Some of us have been practicing the faith diligently now for quite some time. Others of us are in the midst of a serious conversion. For others of us, the conversion will begin today. The scripture says, now is the day of salvation. That day is today for a good number of us. And a crucial component of our conversions is confession. Some of us go regularly. Some of us maybe make it a point to go each year at the men's conference. Some of us haven't been in years, maybe even decades. We don't even remember how to go, and we're afraid. Now, we might not admit that to each other, but God knows we're afraid, not just afraid of saying out loud to another what we've done. In fact, it's ridiculous to think that people are embarrassed to go to confession because they don't say to others what they do. People go to confession all the time. They just don't go to confession to a priest. Friday night at a bar, what are they doing? They're going to confession. Usually takes a shot or a pint to loosen them up, but they're going to confession. They sit there and they tell someone else, I can't believe what I did this past week. What's Oprah other than confession for some people? Or some of the other talk shows that you see on TV. We have this felt need to tell people what we've done. We all go to confession. We just don't do it to a man in a collar. So we're not afraid so much of saying it out loud. I think we're afraid that God won't be quite so merciful with me. You, probably. You, I understand. And there's no question God loves you, but not me. Not after what I've done. I think that's how Peter was. So watch and see what happens to Peter, so that we can see just how amazing God is and what it is he wants to have happen with us. While the apostles are fishing, gospel tells us that Jesus appears on the shore, only they don't recognize that it's Jesus. And so we ask them, have you caught anything? And they answer, no. Now, is it just me here, or do other people wonder how in the world these guys made a living? I mean, what kind of fishermen were they? They never seem to catch anything in the gospels. So Jesus says, well, try the other side of the boat. Apparently they never thought of that, and so suddenly they do that, and the nets are filled to the point of breaking. 153 fish is what it says later in the gospel. And at this, John looks at the guys and says, it's the Lord, for he remembers something like this happened once before. And everyone starts swimming for the shore or rowing in the boat, anxious to get there to see him. These kinds of stories, by the way, are great evidence for the historicity of the gospels, for their trustworthiness. Because you can bet if you and I had made up the Gospels with the intent of trying to get people to join our club, well, then you and I would have made ourselves look a little bit better than this. And so it would have been with the apostles. But they're just candid. They reveal themselves, flaws and warts and all. So Peter gets to the shore first, it says. And when he arrives, he sees Jesus standing on the shore right next to a charcoal fire. Now, it's real important to know that there is only one other time in the whole Bible where a charcoal fire shows up. And it just happens to be three chapters before this in John's Gospel. And it just happens to involve Peter and Jesus. Because it was around that charcoal fire that the most humiliating moment of Peter's life took place. The moment that's caused him such guilt and such shame. The moment when he who had promised such heroic boldness turned into such a coward. Pretty easy to relate to, isn't it? And now Peter sees Jesus standing right next to that same kind of fire. Why? Well, I think Jesus intentionally builds the fire precisely to let Peter know that he has seen what he did, what happened on that terrible Thursday night or Friday morning when Peter denied the Lord. But he doesn't build it to rub his nose in his failure. He builds it to teach him about the power of real mercy and real forgiveness. He builds it so that when they're done with what's about to happen, Peter can leave in peace and with a brand new confidence. At this charcoal fire takes place the first conversation that we know of between Jesus and Peter recorded in the Gospel of John after the resurrection. All these weeks, so far as we know, Peter's been on edge, still amazed about the Lord's being alive, still shocked at what he's seen, but still wondering when the talk is going to happen, when the shoe is going to drop, when the anvil is going to fall from the sky. And as soon as they're done eating, it begins. Jesus turns to Peter and asks him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And I got to believe Peter's thinking, okay, here we go. I'm going to say yes, and he is going to light into me and ask, "Then what happened back there at the fire? And how could you have denied me?" But when Peter answers and says, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you," that's not what Jesus says at all. Instead, he says, "Tend my sheep." And so it goes two more times. "Simon, son of John, do you love me? Tend my sheep." And suddenly, a wave of forgiveness rushes over Peter, and he knows he's been forgiven. He knows that the Lord hasn't revoked the promises, knows that it all still holds. In fact, because of his awareness of how badly and how easily a person can blow it, he's now going to be the perfect dispenser of God's mercy to others. What happened at that fire, I would suggest, is exactly what Jesus wants to have happen with so many of us at this time in the sacrament of confession. He wants to sit down with us through the mediation of his ministers, the priests to whom he gave on that Easter Sunday his own authority to forgive sins, so that we can experience in our own lives the same wave of release that Peter experienced that day, so that we can be free from those moments of guilt and shame that have haunted some of us for many years now. Perhaps we've got an addiction to pornography, but have been ashamed or embarrassed to bring it to the Lord. Maybe there's an affair in our past. Maybe there was cooperation with an abortion years ago. Perhaps we've stolen something or been dishonest in our work. Maybe we've held on to bitterness or resentment towards a family member or a former friend. Some of us, we've been to confession perhaps over the years, but these things we haven't brought into the light. We've brought most of the stuff, but not quite all of this, because we haven't been able to muster up the nerve to say these because we weren't really sure that God would forgive them. But the beauty and the gift of Christian forgiveness, as we learn from that seashore in John's Gospel, is that it isn't something vague and abstract. Jesus doesn't just tell Peter he's forgiven. In building the fire, Jesus lets Peter know that he's forgiven for precisely that moment which perpetually harasses him in his thoughts, the moment when he denied his best friend, the moment when he failed to live with the integrity that he so desires to live with. And so it is with us in confession. We get to hear, this is the grace of the sacrament, that God forgives that, whatever that is. It's said that Teresa of Avila, a great Spanish mystic of the 16th century, after she would go to confession herself, used to stand outside the confessional in the convent where she lived. And she'd greet the other sisters after they emerged from the celebration of the sacrament. And as she would greet them, she would stop them and place her hand on their shoulders, and then look them each in the eye and say two words, "Begin again." That's what God is offering to us right now, a chance to begin again, to start all over, a chance to leave behind whatever's been tormenting us or keeping us from living in the peace and the freedom of God that he has for us. Don't worry if you haven't been to confession in years. If it helps, I didn't go for 10 years myself. And they were 10 pretty juicy years, from 15 to 25 or so. And now I go about every 2 weeks. Don't worry if you don't remember how to do it. The priest you're going to go to, he'll gladly and calmly help you through it. Perhaps an image might be helpful here, though. I often liken and think of confession as a shower. Some of us have broken various bones in our bodies over the years, perhaps from playing sports and whatnot, and had to enjoy the fun of trying to take a shower with a plastic bag tied around our hand or our foot. I can remember countless occasions when I had to hold my arm or my foot outside the shower curtain so that the bag didn't get wet and the cast didn't get ruined. The result, of course, was that it didn't get clean. Well, confession is like a shower in that we need to bring under the nozzle of God's grace and His mercy everything that we can remember that we've done since we've been to confession that was gravely wrong, that we knew was wrong, and that we just did anyway. And as we hold it under that nozzle of His mercy, it all just gets washed away. That sounds, I know, way too good to be true. There's a part of us, that part of us that hears the voice of the evil one telling us it can happen for others, but it cannot happen for me. But that's a lie. It's true. It all just gets washed away. We just have to say it. Jesus has built in our lives, and at this time in our lives, countless charcoal fires. And He's standing right now beside them, inviting us to come and to sit down with Him, to know His love, to experience His mercy, and to leave profoundly aware that no matter what's in our past, no matter what we leave behind at that fireside, He still has great things for us to do. And not just for some of us, but for all of us. For there is so much work to be done in this culture and in this archdiocese, and it won't get done unless you and I step forward. And you and I can't step forward, at least not with any real confidence, until we know that it's all okay, that we're really forgiven, and that we can begin again. So let's run to sit down with Him at the fire, who is there waiting for us.
On this edition of Christ is the Answer, we've heard two men's conference talks by Father John Ricardo. The first, Tirelessly Running the Race, was from the Archdiocese of Detroit's 2013 men's event. The second, A Fireside Chat with the Lord, was from a 2008 Massachusetts men's conference. This has been Christ is the Answer program number 700. For a CD of this or any of our programs, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on Store or order by leaving a voicemail at 734-930-4506. 734-930-4506 for program number 700, Tirelessly Running the Race. Father John Ricardo is a priest of the Archdiocese of Detroit and is currently the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Acts 29, which exists to work with pastors and their teams to transform their parish culture and reclaim the church's missionary identity. He was ordained in 1996. Christ is the Answer was originally recorded and edited by Henry Root and is a production of AveMariaRadio.net. Tune in next time when Father John Ricardo addresses a topic of Christian concern from the Catholic perspective. This is Ave Maria Radio.